Hey, welcome back, everybody. Time once again for our journey we call Living Hope. A weekly journey designed to provide hope, inspiration, and education for those living with pancreatic cancer. Sharing the real-life stories of those really affected by this deadly disease and how they deal with it on a daily basis. With a woman, she spent a moment or two thinking about this subject here herself, Roberta Luna. Welcome back, Roberta.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate that.
Every time I think that you've explored every single angle to talk about, you've got a new one. Today you've got a new one, Tools for Caregivers. That'll be interesting to talk about.
It will be, and that's one of those things. Yeah, a lot of people think, how can you talk so much about pancreatic cancer? But trust me, subjects are there. They never run out, which I'm thankful that we can at least spend the time and talk about some things and educate some people, right?
Absolutely. So who'd you bring with you today?
Yeah, today I have Ashley Baylor, and she was a caregiver for her father, and with her journey that what she went through is where she created some of these apps and programs that we're going to be able to use and learn more about, called the Baylor Strong Project. Correct? Did I get that right?
You did.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us today. We're really happy to have you. It's been a while since I've seen you.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit, or as much as you want to share, about your dad and how you got started in all this?
Yes. So my dad was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer in 2019 at the top of the year. And he was having symptoms prior to, so in 2018 is when we started noticing some things, but we didn't know anything about the symptoms of pancreatic cancer. So we just figured he was getting older and he was around the age where stuff starts acting funny with your body, and he was dropping weight and couldn't put it back on. But my dad was also type 2 diabetic, so we attributed everything that he was experiencing to his diabetes having a problem, and him not being able to pick the weight back up, and his blood sugar being in a range that it shouldn't have been is what alerted his primary physician to call for a CT scan, because she figured something else had to be going on. And at the top of the year in 2019 is when he got the final diagnosis. And that's when we found out that he not only had it, but it had already spread to his liver and his spleen.
What kind of test did they do to get your dad's diagnosis?
The CT scan is the one that primarily caught it. Before then, they were running a lot of blood tests and checking his blood sugar levels, but none of those things alerted them. And so it didn't pick up at all. If it wasn't for the CT scan, they wouldn't have caught it.
So had he had diabetes for a number of years, or was that something that was new?
He did have diabetes for several years. So he was diagnosed initially in his early 50s with diabetes. My mom said it was a bit sooner than that, but my earliest knowledge of it was when he was in his early 50s. So he had it for about a decade before he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer.
And did he do any kind of treatment or have any surgery or anything?
He was not qualified for the surgery because of where the tumor was located and because it had already spread. So he immediately started on standard chemo initially, and then they moved him to immunotherapy after about 7 to 8 months when they felt like it was stable enough. So they were working on getting his numbers down because they were really high up in the thousands. And then once they got it stabilized, they switched him over to immunotherapy. He was on gemcitabine for a while.
Yeah, that's a pretty common or standard of care. The immunotherapy, can you just explain that a little bit, what that is, and if your dad had any side effects with that at all?
Yes. So immunotherapy is different from your standard chemotherapy. Immunotherapy is where they still treat the targeted issue of the tumor, but they utilize your own immune system. So they use drugs to help boost that so that your immune system will attack the tumor itself.
And you said your mom, did you become the main caregiver, or was your mom, or did you guys share in that role, or do you have siblings as well? Did you all share in that role?
Yes. So I do have siblings. I'm the youngest, and we were the ones that shared in the role. My dad didn't want my mom burdened with any of his treatments. He didn't want us burdened, period. So we really had to fight him tooth and nail to let us be there for him. He was relatively independent, which was helpful. So there were some things that we didn't have to help with, but with things he did need us for, me and my sisters split up the responsibilities, which was helpful.
So did you find going from daughter to caregiver anything in there that was difficult, or is a totally different role, correct?
Yes. It was, for us, it was more so difficult emotionally. We didn't know how to process this larger than life man, someone that we highly respected and really in a lot of ways saw as our superhero. We thought our dad was invincible. And to see how this cancer impacted him, how it bothered him mentally, what it did to him emotionally, and of course what it was doing to him physically, that was really hard on us emotionally. We had a difficult time being in his presence for long periods of time because we didn't want to weigh him down with our sorrow and sadness. We were scrambling, trying to figure out all the ways that we could help him as best as possible. And because we didn't have the knowledge that we have now, we felt helpless a lot. There was so much we didn't think we could do. And each of us, ironically, are in healthcare in some fashion and aspect. So we just dove in where our strengths were. I was in school at the time studying kinesiology, and I do have a biology degree as well. So I made my dad my case study. I was in my research classes, writing papers about my dad and using it as an opportunity to learn what I could, asking my professors a lot of questions to see if I can gain any knowledge from them because they were in the healthcare space still as professors. And there was a lot to unpack, and we still didn't have a lot of answers at the time. So we were frantic, panicking inwardly a lot, but controlling how we expressed that externally because we wanted him to be encouraged. He needed that encouragement. So that was what was the hardest part for us as a family.
So going into being a caregiver and not having any training really or planning on it, did doctors help? Did nurses help? Was there anybody that helped you guys through it or guided you in what you could do or what needed to be done?
We had no help at all. And it's not because his care team wasn't great. We just didn't know. A part of that was my dad. He didn't want us going to his treatments with him. We had to beg to go to chemo sessions with him. His oncologist was phenomenal. It was about a year of him being on treatment before he even agreed to allow me to meet his oncologist because I wanted to interview him. And unfortunately, his cancer did take a turn. And so I did not ever get that opportunity. But I was excited when he did finally agree because I wanted to learn what I could. But throughout his treatment, we were fully isolated with the experience and we didn't know anything at all.
Because of what you went through with your dad, you created some tools. One, I know it was a care guide app. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So I offer free guides that can be found on my website. You can download them and they're yours once you have them. And it was just, I was like, okay, what questions should we ask? We didn't know what questions to ask. So the guide has questions that you should ask initially. And they're more so just to inspire you because you may have other questions that come about that aren't on the guide. And so they're just to help you get started. We also have nutritional suggestions because I always make sure I position myself and let people know I am not the expert in a lot of fields. These are just observations and things I know from me either being in school or from working in hospitals and talking to dietitians and nutritionists. And so we have a nutrition part of the guide that just gives suggestions and things you can research on your own. And then there's a financial part of the guide as well, because a lot of families are financially impacted by the treatment that's required for pancreatic cancer. And I always ask families when they do consultations with me, how far are you willing to go? How bad do you want to fight? That's going to determine what you need for this journey. And so it provides just a financial roadmap, things that they can check out and consider that could potentially help them.
Is there a link you can share with everybody if they want to go and check that out?
Yes. If you go to BaylorStrongProject.com/BaylorStrongProject and you head over to the resources tab on our page, you'll be able to locate those free guides.
Thank you. And then you have a Caregiver's Corner newsletter. What is that?
I do. So the Caregiver's Corner newsletter is my blog. It's free. is for caregivers. Sometimes I do have those who are impacted by pancreatic cancer themselves who like to join. And it's just a monthly, bi-monthly newsletter that goes out on all the latest information that you can find out. And sometimes the basics, because I meet a lot of new families who just received the diagnosis. And so I'm resharing information and re-educating often, but it's a corner specifically for caregivers to prep them and help them and essentially have a buddy, if you will, bi-monthly of what you can look into, what to expect. I share the links to the research that I come across and caregiver tips and things to consider, because I'm really big on caregivers knowing that you have to care for yourself in addition to caring for your loved one, because that's what helps your loved one even more, is if you make sure that you are taking care of you as well.
And I was going to ask you that a little later, but since you did bring it up, so how does a caregiver care for themselves? Because I know when I took care of my mom and dad, I felt really guilty if I felt like I needed time or I needed to do something. So I didn't take that time. I was with them all the time. But so how do you deal with that?
I always deal with it by reminding myself that life is full of hard decisions. What's another hard one? Because it is difficult and you do carry that guilt. You feel like you're either being selfish or you feel like you're going to miss something. And so I oftentimes tell caregivers, what is most encouraging to your loved one is when you are living a normal life. Because we both know that once this diagnosis comes into our lives, are forever changed. Nothing is the same anymore. And if you can grasp hold of the things that keep you uplifted, that keep you going in a very dark space, it is actually more encouraging for your loved one because it gives them more hope to fight and it lets them know that the whole world hasn't fallen apart around them. So, for example, when I was caring for my dad, we still did all of his favorite things and I was still working and going to school and I still hung out with my friends. My life didn't stop just because we were caring for our father. We still did things. We still spent time together as a family. My dad still preached. He was a pastor. He still preached every week. He made sure his treatments were scheduled around him being able to be in the pulpit and spend time with our congregation. So we didn't allow things to stop life from happening, because that's just the nature of living, right? Things don't stop just because suffering has entered the picture. You have to find ways to keep yourself going. So even if it's just 5 minutes to yourself in your schedules, if it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, you have to be deliberate about taking that time to yourself, or you'll end up like me with severe anxiety and now you are unable to function day to day. Because you've now emotionally brought yourself to a place of dysfunction. So I highly recommend holding on to moments for yourself.
And I think that's really wise, because being in the position, I was a caregiver as well, but being the patient survivor, we carry a lot of guilt when our family is having to make life changes. So by continuing as normal as possible, it really takes something off the patient's shoulder as well, because then you don't feel like you're that burden. That, not that we are, but it's still something we feel. And I know my mom and dad both felt they were burdened, and they weren't. We took care of them because we wanted to. We loved them. But to continue as much as possible, a normal life as much, does a lot for the patient. I don't think people really realize that until you've been there, right? So what surprised you most about caregiving?
I think that what surprised me most was how people don't understand it unless they're in it. When you think about caregiving, it on the outside is simple. You're caring for somebody. But when you're in it, people on the outside don't get what it really takes. You don't really realize that caregiving is like a 9-to-5 job. And then you have to become an expert at things suddenly that you never thought to think about, because there was no need for you to have to think about those things. So now you need to become an expert about somebody else's health. Now you need to become a financial expert, because now we need to have your affairs in order because we don't really know what the outcome is going to be, although we're hoping for the best. You don't realize that you actually need to clean your life up in order to care for somebody and actually maybe reprioritize and reorganize some things. And then you also surprisingly don't realize how meaningless a lot of things are until you have to care for somebody else. And it just completely changed my mindset about what I actually care about as a person. What do I actually value? And that reshaped how I view the world and how I approach people. It also made me more compassionate because with caregiving, you unpack a lot of things you don't even realize are an issue for yourself. Life is passing before your eyes at this moment as you're watching your loved one and you're hoping that you can do whatever you can. And then I would say lastly, realizing that maybe you're not a superhuman. I often tell families, I'm like, your loved one doesn't need you to be their superhero. You're not superhuman. You don't have magic powers. You're a human just like them. And all they need for you to do is to be there and to love them. It is not our job to step in and now be Superman. So those were some of the surprising revelations for me as a caretaker.
Was there a particular moment or something that happened that made you realize caregivers needed more support than what they were actually getting?
Oh my goodness, several. But I think the moment it really hit me was there was a Sunday where I helped my dad change out of his clothes and he was in so much pain. And there was nothing I could do, obviously, to relieve that pain. And we wept together. And I was like, we can't do this by ourselves. That was the moment where it really hit me, where I was just like, we need a village. We need support. And then when he was on hospice, my dad was a very private man, so there was nothing much we could really do about having anybody step in. But just the week of him being on hospice was the hardest part of the entire experience. And I was like, we need help. Because that's when all the stuff really hit us. We're finding out about his assets and what he has set aside for us and who's the beneficiary on what and how are we prepping for, does he want to be cremated versus this? Like, all of these things are now hitting us day after day on top of us having to watch, okay, when is he taking his last breath? The doctors say he has 2 months, but does he really have 2 months left? So there were a lot of things that came at us that made me realize you cannot do this if you do not have a supportive village. Who is your team? Not just the care team at the hospital, but who are your friends, your family that are strong enough to come alongside you and assist you all through this entire process?
And is that how the Baylor Strong Project started because of that?
Yes. So initially I started off just as fundraising. I was like, okay, we got to donate to research. That was the first big thing. And I reached out to a close friend of mine who recommended a nonprofit to me that I could help. And so I started there. And then after a few years of doing that, after prayer and some life changes that happened, I felt led to start the Baylor Strong Project as a full-on business. And just being able to provide both free and paid resources to families, because I didn't want anybody going through what our family went through. I was like, I know that there are other families out there like mine, and I would absolutely hate to see somebody be isolated and do this by themselves. It's just an awful experience. So the Baylor Strong Project was built with that in mind, that you need a friend. And to date, I've had several families who I've consulted with who say that they now see me like a sister. And I was like, great, that's the goal. I want you to see me like extended family, where you know for certain that if you have nobody else who gets it, somebody that you need to talk to, Ashley is here and I completely understand. So that was my passion and still is. And we've been 3 years officially established, and I'm very proud of the work that we've been able to do.
Congratulations, and thank you for what you do. I do appreciate it. can caregivers, can you separate yourself from the caregiver than from the daughter?
It's strange because in my mind I can, but that's because I already operate in healthcare spaces. So I was already either working for clinics or working in hospitals, working in spas. And so I already see myself as a healthcare provider. But if you are a caretaker who is not in the healthcare industry, I do recommend that you work on compartmentalizing that identity. Because as a caregiver, you have to be sober-minded in the decision-making. As the child, that can be a little difficult because you're emotional, because this is somebody you love and you want to save them. So you do have to work on compartmentalizing. That was a bit easier for me to do just because I already was in those spaces. But if that's not a space you are typically used to navigating, you're going to have to work on compartmentalizing your roles and understanding that they are different.
Yeah, it would be hard, I think. Well, it was for me to step away from being the caregiver to the daughter, but sometimes you do have to do that, like you say, especially my dad was like your dad. He was very private, so there were times when things you need to do, a daughter shouldn't be doing, right? So it can be very difficult. So when families do come to you, what do you hear from them the most often that their struggle is as far as being a caregiver?
Most of the time, they're struggling with how to process that this is even happening. The classic question, why us? Why my loved one? They're a good person. Why did this happen to them? And then the other struggle they have is with knowing what's worth it to pursue treatment-wise. Should we bother with chemo? And I always ask them, what do you really want out of this? Your why is going to determine the decisions you make for your loved one. But also, what do they want? What are their goals? And I always remind caregivers when they come to me with those questions, this really is about them. You need to know what their goals are, what their desires are. And then as their caregiver, how are you going to help them meet those goals and what their desires are? You cannot make it about you, because at the end of the day, we're not the ones with the cancer. They are. So I help them keep those things in mind. And then the last question that I get a lot is, how do I recognize the signs of the end? When do I know that it's time? Because of course, naturally, many of them are worried about that. And so I have to help them navigate their anticipatory grief, is what it's called. They're expecting this to happen just in case, so that the proverbial anvil doesn't fall. But I tell them, I'm like, it's different for everybody. These are some signs that could give you an inclination, but it just depends on the person. And they're oftentimes really receptive of that.
You're right. It is individual because we all handle it differently, right? What gives you hope when you look at the pancreatic cancer community today?
What gives me hope is, one, that they are approving all the research that we're backing. Because many of us, like yourself, we partner with Hirschberg, we partner with other nonprofits, and all we want to see is that the advocacy, the fundraising, all the work that we do, the progress is actually there. And hearing about Diraxonrasib, that they finally approved it, and now it's FDA approved, and now people are having more access to it, and seeing the clinical trials, seeing all the advocates like ourselves who are traveling, and we have the podcast like Living Hope, just seeing all that's out there and available is what gives me hope. And also meeting more survivors. When I was able to meet you and to meet Jerry and all the many survivors that I've met over the past few years, it has been such a blessing. And it's always emotional for me because families also ask me that question. They're like, do you know any survivors? I'm like, yes, I know plenty. I know plenty of people who are living well. And that's what gives me hope, because it's not just about survival. It's about the fact that you all are thriving. Your families are thriving. You all are doing magnificent work. And so then I get to brag and tell people about you. And I'm like, I have the perfect people for you to talk to.
Yeah, it has come a long way, and I'm also very happy to see survivors. And I want to thank you for being here with us today, for joining me, because the lessons that you're teaching us as a caregiver, I think, are very important, because it's something that even when I went through it, I didn't have either. It was just like the blind leading the blind, so to say. I'm sorry, that may not be politically correct. I'm sorry, but it was very difficult to come into that. So the work you're doing with the Baylor Strong Project is really helping families get more informed and supported, and I really thank you for that. And you want to give us the website again that people can go and visit?
Yes, if you follow BaylorStrongProject.com/BaylorStrongProject, that is my website, and it is Baylor spelled like the university.
Thank you for joining us today, and I'd love to have you come back sometime and talk a little bit more, but time goes by so quickly, and I'm getting the signals over here, so I better let you go so we can go. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
As Long As You Speak My Name, I Shall Live Forever is dedicated to Dr. Johnny Baylor, Ashley's beloved father. Dr. Baylor is known for his big, unforgettable laugh, the kind that could bring him to tears. Known as the jokester of the Baylor family, Dr. Bailey also brought warmth, humor, and connection to his preaching and teaching, touching lives around the world. Though he is deeply missed, his memory and impact continue to live on through the lives he changed and through the work Ashley carries forward in his Baylor Strong. Thank you.
There you have it. One more reason to tune in each and every time to Living Hope, a show designed to provide hope, inspiration, education, and tools in this case for those dealing with this journey we call pancreatic cancer. And if you or somebody you know needs help right away, lots of places, we give one out every week. Let's shout out to the Hirschberg organization. I believe it's pancreatic.org. That's it, pancreatic.org. Go check them out. Great work that they're doing up there at UCLA and others around the country. And if nothing else, come back and join us each and every week as we continue to share this journey and provide information, education, and hope. Right here from our hopeful studio here at OC Talk Radio, streaming live from the University of California, Irvine's Beale Blind Innovation Center.